Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Tonight's speaker is Michael S., and his home group is the Old Town Speakers Group. It's a big group. How's everybody doing tonight? Good? All right. Well, my name is Michael Shove, and I'm an alcoholic, and my home group is the Old Town Speakers Group in Old Town, Alexandria, Virginia. And we meet every Friday night at 8 o'clock. And we'd love to have you guys, if you're ever about 300 miles south of here, and you're just in the neighborhood, stop by. I have a sobriety date. It is April 25th of 2008. I also have a sponsor. And I have the privilege and honor of sponsoring a number of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, my job's really simple here tonight. So over the next few hours, I'm going to share with you guys sometimes I could go there. When it comes to me talking about me, I can go on for a long time. So my sponsor gave me really specific directions. He said, you know, just do your best to be getting really sober by halftime. And you know, just be real clear and concise, no unique ideas. Just talk about this solution and how it works in your life. And, you know, I'm a blessed member of AA today. This is by no means my first run in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm actually on my third run in AA. I have a lot of experience. My sponsor told me early on, the sponsor I have today, and he said, Michael, God gives us one of two jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. You have the job of being an example of what to do, and if you choose not to take that job, you get the job of being an example of what not to do. But let's get something straight. No one's unemployed. And so, you know, what I found in my experience is this, that I have a lot of experience in what to do, and what's effective and what we have to offer. And I also have a lot of experience steering very wide from that path, and I can paint a very clear picture of what not to do as well. And one thing, you know, that I've found is very, very true in, with these principles that we have in life is that, you know, no matter what I do in my life, it all has a price tag. Absolutely everything. It all has an action and a reaction. And it's not so much what I feel or what I think or my opinion or even so much, you know, all of my experiences. It's more than anything. It's what I choose to do that gets me what I get, you know. And so I'm here today, hopefully tonight, to just share with you guys my experience of what it was like coming into these, or actually a little bit about my experience before I got here. My experience coming into AA, because it was quite interesting to me. And my experience of staying here, you know. And I'll tell you this much, my first drink was a really phenomenal experience. I rank it amongst my top 10 experiences in all my life. And I was a young man at the age of 14. Now, mind you, if I could paint a picture of myself at this age, if you could see a guy, I weighed about, it's about the height I am now. I haven't grown much since, I don't know if it's due to all the broken bones that came from drinking, but I haven't grown much since high school. But I came into high school a little shorter than I am, weighing about 130 pounds soaking wet. This was my outfit, I had a nice pair of cargo shorts on, right? Came high above the knee, mind you. And I had my socks pulled up with my Birkenstocks on and a nice pressed polo shirt. You know what I mean? It's just a really out-of-place look. And I was just one of these preppy, kind of off-the-wall kids. But I was brought up in this home that we were really isolated from the secular world. Very, very much so. I mean, by the time I got to high school in 1993, I hadn't even heard of Metallica yet, all right, or Pink Floyd. I mean, I was completely off in the dark. And when we were brought up, we had, you know, Christian radio. We had Christian, you know, everything, church 17 times a week. We had, you know, a very sheltered life. There was no trick-or-treating, I mean, none of this stuff. So, you know, the one outlet that I had in my life was soccer. I played sports, and I was a really good ball player. Actually to a point where I played all over the state of Maryland, I played all over the eastern region, and played a little bit throughout the country. And so by the time I get to high school, about the only thing I have outside of a religious experience is the ability to play soccer. And you know, that first couple weeks before high school starts up, They have, you know, fall sports tryouts. So I go to these tryouts, and within the first practice, I've already made varsity team, you know, as a freshman. And within the third, you know, the third day of practice, I've already established camaraderie amongst my peers. And that one talent and ability, it kind of put me at a level of equality with these guys. And so probably it was about a week into it, these guys had asked me, I said, hey, Shof, can you come out tonight to a party? And I'd never had anybody ask me that. So I said, well, let me ask my mom. So I asked my mom and dad, and, you know, I'm a spitting age of 14, and my mom and dad, they had no reason not to trust me at this point in my life. I mean, none at all. So they said, just make sure you have him home by 10 o'clock. So we go to this party at this barn, and it's very similar to the surroundings I'm in now. In Northern Virginia, it's not really like this, but in here it was kind of a little bit off out of Western Maryland, and we went out to this barn, and I remember walking in, and I encountered hoodlums to the likes I had never encountered before. It was quite freaky, actually. You know, like I said, I'm here in my nice little shorts with my pulled-up socks and my Birks and my pressed polo shirt, and you know, nice little tight haircut parted to one side, and you know, these guys there's white guys with dreadlocks. There are guys with bandanas. There are people of every color and culture you could imagine. It was like being in here, but we were all drinking. You know what I mean? And I guess I could see that too. But you know what I mean? It was very odd. And I walked into this place, and these guys, as soon as I walked in, they had offered me a handle of Jack Daniels. You know what? I intuitively knew in my gut that was not the right thing to be doing. I mean, really. I mean, I'm a buck 35. I'm out of place. No, I don't need Jack Daniels. You know, it doesn't take a whole lot of common sense to know that. So I passed. Then about another 5 minutes, 10 minutes into the party, I was offered a joint. Now, as I remember it, it was big. And it was a monster. Reality is a lot of what I tell you guys tonight is what I remember to be true. I can't guarantee it. Most of it has been told to me by others, but I've been known to be delusional. So some of what I do remember is actually brought to my attention as the years go by is not necessarily exactly right. But I do remember this joint, and I've been told that it wasn't quite that big, you know. As I told this story once in a room of one of the guys I partied with, he said, Mike, it wasn't like that. But I remember it big. And I had DARE in middle school, and I knew drugs were bad. And I said, no thank you. And I was just out, you know, out of that situation. About another 10 or 15 minutes, about a half an hour into my evening, I saw these guys back in the back corner. And they were on these hay bales, and they had this funnel. And it had a tube. And I was mesmerized by this. And I just, this guy, Steve, I said, can I try that? And he said, sure. I mean, I at this point saw no alcohol, but I saw jovial wonder and just, it just had me captivated. And so we went back and we put three Milwaukee's Beasts into this funnel. And I got up on this hay bale. And I put the tube in my mouth, and I raised it up, and I bonged it like a champ. And I'm going to tell you what, I'm here to report that I was a social drinker for the next 20 minutes. And everything changed immediately. And but I take a lot of time to tell that story, and it's one of the few that I take a lot of time to tell, because it is so well burnt into my being. Now, you could ask anybody, you know, anything about their life. You can ask me, like, what I ate yesterday, and I could not tell you, for the love of me, what I ingested into my body. You could ask me what I did a few days ago, and I really can't tell you that either, but I'll tell you what. I could tell you what I was wearing, what was going on in that room, and I could tell you how my life changed that night and that one evening. And I put those three beers down in me, you know what, and I felt okay, but about 20 minutes later, that beer actually hit me. And here's what happened. Is everything in my life absolutely changed, but nothing was different. You know what? I didn't get 10 foot tall, and I didn't get bulletproof, and I wasn't this amazing man by any stretch of the imagination. But I know this, for the first time in my life, I absolutely loved being me. And I knew comfort in my own skin like I'd never known it before. I didn't need anybody to change differently. I didn't need my parents to approve of me. I didn't need anything to happen. But I knew this, I absolutely was okay with me. There was something inside of me, deep inside, that was absolutely satisfied and filled. And I knew life like it should be. And all of a sudden, I realized I'd been afraid my whole life. You know what I mean? Like, you'd ask me what's wrong, I'd say nothing. Same way we do in here. Oh, nothing. You know, I'm fine. You know, I was always fine until I knew what it was like to not be fine, to not be, you know, to be fine. And then I was like, wow, I've never been fine. And so I set out on this mission to feel that way for the rest of my life, you know. Now, you know, my experience took me down a lot of different roads. You know, as an alcoholic, I deal with a few things, you know. I deal with the fact that, you know what, I have a physical allergy to alcohol. I have this crazy, twisted mental obsession, but I have this spiritual malady, and the malady is really where it began, is where the untreated malady is where alcoholism really began to get bad. It's because I found something for the first time in my life that fixed me on the inside, and I'm here to tell you that from that day, that very first day when I took that drink, I found a solution, an absolute solution, and from that day to this, I believe from the bottom of my heart that alcohol is and always will be my solution. It's never been a problem, ever once. And if it was a problem, I spent a lot of years trying to just not drink and be okay. And I get crazy when I don't drink and just don't drink, you know. And I put that bottle down and nothing got better, man. Nothing got better. And so what I've experienced in this is that, you know, what I had found there was a solution. And what I've got to do by the time I got in here was find a sufficient substitute. I need to find another solution. You know, because just putting down the bottle wasn't enough. When I stopped drinking, I managed to actually lose a lot of things just not drinking. I think I've lost more just not drinking than I did getting wasted. But anyhow, that's later on. So what ended up happening was, to make a long story really short, man, I spent the next, you know, years of my high school life, by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I had accumulated 3 DWIs. About 17 other charges. I had been removed from the county, Washington County in Maryland. I was living in a recovery house or halfway house out in Annapolis, Maryland. I had a backpack and I had a trash bag, and that was it, man. That's what I had in my name. Freaking 18 years or at 18 years old. And here's what ended up happening was, the court system strongly encouraged that I get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a suggestion, but, you know, like I said, you know, there were consequences to not following it, and so I thought, you know, I'm going to go ahead and try this out. So here at 18 years old, this is my first experience with AA. As I walk into a room much smaller than this in Hagerstown, Maryland, it's called Fellowship Hall, and I walked in, and there were tables on the sides, and then there were chairs kind of all up in the center, and I went in, and I went to the front. There was a table and a man sitting there, and he would talk for a little bit and then open the meeting up. And I knew that this guy needed to sign my slip. And so I took my slip up to him, and he said he would give it back to me afterwards. And I didn't like that idea, because what if something were to happen? Like, I would have to go, you know, by chance. And you just never know what could have to happen. I mean, yeah, what if I had to go to the bathroom, or so my mom called, whatever. So this guy didn't. He said, well, then get it the next time you come to the meeting. That was good, you know. That's how alcoholics are. The old-timers, man, they always have an answer. You know what I mean? And these guys had answers. So I'll get it next time. That's pretty swift. But I didn't like it. So I remember probably my third or fourth or fifth time there, I just went up and I threw this god-awful fit, you know. You need to give me my slip. Give me my slip. And this guy wouldn't. And I'm telling you, I threw a temper tantrum like I was a six-year-old little kid. And finally, he said, you know what? And he reached back in his desk and he opened this drawer up. And there, I've been back to this meeting hall since. I've never found them there ever one time. But he pulled out about 10 sheets of these blue slips. And on each sheet, you have about 5 slots, right? And so he just sits there and just starts filling them out. And he gave me like 50 meetings worth of slips. And he said, now just go and leave us alone. I was like, what? You have a primary purpose. You can't tell me to leave, you know? And but you know what, I didn't want to be there, but then when they told me not to come back, I was angry. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't cool. And so I went home, and I drank resentfully for a few days, and I don't know if it was resentment, it was, you know, subtle frustration. And So anyhow, I finally, after a few days, I came back, and I remember going to the front, and there was a guy named Tom there, and he had this eye. It was kind of weird. And I went up to Tom, and he says, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yes, sir. I want to be in charge." So I told him, God's honest truth, man. And Tom, in all of his lovingness, he wrapped his arm around my shoulder, and he walked me to the very back row. He sat me 3 seats in, and he said, "Son, you can be in charge of this row." It's a true story. And here's what's really worse about it, right? For that week, guys would come into the meeting, and I'd be like, "Shh, shh." I'd be like keeping quiet. There's a meeting going on. You know what I mean? And I like took charge of the back row. And then like this stuff began to happen. People would smack me and, you know, tell me I was just an idiot and all kinds of things. And I caught on that the joke was on me. But I tell that story for the sole purpose that what I did my first time coming into Alcoholics Anonymous is I came into AA with a need to be in charge, you know? And I didn't stay sober. You know, I came to learn real early on when I took that first step, you know, is that I've got, you know, that I'm powerless over alcohol. And I have a serious symptom here of this allergy. But what's really the kicker, right, is if I were powerless over alcohol even to this day and I had a manageable life, I don't know that I would have found my way into AA. You know what I mean? I've got this real problem in manageability. And I really suck at the whole management deal. And what I've really come to find in the freedom that I have today in AA is that I no longer have a stance of management. I have found an absolute new manager in my life. I found a whole new employer. I have a God-dependent life, you know, today. And I'm free from managing. I still like to get involved on occasion, but what I found is that was it, dude. I was just trying to manage my life, and I couldn't do it, man. I was all about being in charge. The single biggest problem in my life is right here, you know, and I was using it to manage. So I didn't stay sober, and I ended up, you know, flipping and flopping through Alcoholics Anonymous. All right? What ended up happening was I did that for a while. I went into halfway houses, recovery houses. I went into treatment centers. I went into all kinds of stuff. And I go in there, you know what, and my main priority in my life was just to get out of trouble, to not get caught, to gain a little status in my life. You know, like as long as no one caught me drinking, like I'm notorious. I had to give it back. It was my one of my anniversaries. My sponsor said, you know, you need to give back all these chips. And I had this jar of chips that I'd accumulated. I would be 3 days sober picking up 3 month chips. You know, I would just not be getting caught. You know what I mean? And then I'd like, you know, keep on drinking, not getting caught. Then I'd be like a whopping week sober getting my 6 month chip. And then, you know, I have a whole half a mayonnaise jar full of 24 hours. And so I contributed them to the home group at the time that I was back when I finally got my feet moving in the right direction. But you know, I had this, it's flopping history, and what it was the whole time is just me coming in here with a brilliant idea that I knew what I was doing. Really? I got it. You just chill out and watch, you know? And if you need some help, let me know. And that's how I was, and honest to goodness. But what happened was at the age of 20, I'd come to one of the first breaking points in my life. At this point, I was now homeless, jobless. I had a backpack, a trash bag. I had $1.35 to my name. I had nowhere to go. And like every good, you know, 20-year-old kid, I called mom and dad. My mom and dad, you know, they answered the phone. I said, "Hey, I need your help. I don't have anywhere to go. I got drunk again, and I need to come home." And my mom handed the phone to my dad, and my dad said, "You know, Mike, we love you, but we just don't want you. You know, we're sorry, but you have to die somewhere else. We can't watch it." And that was it. And he just hung up. Now, as a father today, I can't even fathom that. But, you know, God's grace, man, and he just put it down. And I tell you, I came to the first point in my life where I just was like, you know what? It just hit me right here. And I looked at my life, and for some reason, I saw it for what it was. 20 years old with nothing. Nothing. And I called AA. And here's another thing I can offer as far as what not to do. God has an unlimited amount of grace. People do not. Do not screw people in the very fellowship that you need to save your ass. You know what I mean? This is like the worst place in the world to burn bridges. And I'll tell you that much, just straight out. I had been running around AA. You know, I'd use you up for everything you had. Use you up for your cigarettes. Use you up for your, you know, place to, you know, lay my head. You know, for your rides, for everything, man. Take, 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 take. take, 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 take. And when I'm done, I'm going to take. And I didn't get back anything, you know. I just felt like it was a privilege and honor for people to share time with me, you know, to help me. And whatever it was, it just seemed right. And I'll tell you what ended up happening was I came to a point where I really needed help, and I was really willing, and I just burnt those bridges, man, and people were just done with me. They really were. And I ended up getting a hold of this one guy. His name was Greg. And Greg came down to Annapolis where I was, and I remember he gave me my first piece. I got into his truck. He pulled his truck up on the curb, and he told me to get in. So I got in the truck, and I started to explain to him what was going on. And he told me to shut up, and he didn't care what was going on. You know, he didn't care at all. And he gave me my first piece of non-conference to prove AA literature. He reached under his seat and he gave me a dictionary. And he had me look up the word sobriety. Now, today I don't go without a dictionary. This experience changed my life forever. But I remember looking in this dictionary and there were three definitions. The first one said, a period of abstinence from drugs and alcohol. You know, pretty common, right? The second definition said, soundness of mind. Right? And the third definition said state of balance. Now, he said, what do you want? What kind of sobriety do you want? And now, I never thought about sobriety as anything other than just not drinking. You know what I mean? If I'm not getting high, I'm not drinking, I must be sober. But I learned that sobriety and recovery are very different things. Now, recovery is optional. We don't force it here. But it is definitely different than just not drinking. And I said, well, I'd like the middle one, actually, because my mind was like Best Buy. Like, you ever been in there on the TV wall where everything's on a different channel, and it's all going loud, and like you just never know what's going on? That was my head pretty consistently. It was always on full blast. I was talking to myself. I was arguing, you know, with the girlfriend I hadn't even gotten yet, and yelling at this person, this employer, and trying to, you know, I'm having a debating, you know, with this counselor I'm about to get, and I haven't even been to outpatient yet, you know, and I'm just yelling and kicking the dog and the cat, and I'm just frustrated with everything in my life and the apartment that it's really not mine anyway, you know, but it's always going on up here, and I said, I like the middle one, you know, or the last one, and he said, I'll tell you what, and he said, he taped a $20 bill to his dashboard. And he said, if you want a drink, it's on me. I'm not in the business of not drinking. I don't know how to do that. He said, but if you're truly done drinking and you want to learn a way of life where you'll never have to drink again, then follow me. And it was just crazy enough to try. You know what I mean? Like, this guy was putting a $20, he was offering to buy me booze. No one in AA had ever done that. People had told me it'd be best if I drank, but no one had just said, here, you go, I'll buy you. I mean, he was just so confident in what he had to offer. And I said, all right. And he just went real quick, man. He took me through these steps pretty fast, pretty quickly. And for those few weeks, I was homeless, I was jobless, and I had nowhere to go. I remember the first 3 weeks sober. Now, you know, some nights I slept on couches, some nights I slept wrapped in plastic. Some nights I actually had the joy of having a warm bed and a warm shower. Other nights it was under a bridge, you know. For 3 weeks I had nowhere to go, but every night, man, I made a meeting. Had a commitment on Thursday nights, this meeting called Dry Dock, on the Naval Base, which they let me into, in Annapolis. And you know what? I wrote a 4-step without a place to live. And I did a 5th step without a place to live. And I began to go into, in my 3rd week of it, man, I was going into Johns Hopkins to a detox center, taking meetings into these guys, and coming out, and they had a bed, and I didn't, you know? And you know what? I wasn't even angry about it. I was okay. And so finally, at the end of 3 weeks, I had this place to live, and I had this little apartment, you know what I mean? A little, like, one-room deal. It was like a cell, but with carpet. And it was pretty swift, man. I had a little egg foam crate mattress, still the same backpack and trash bag with clothes that I got from a treatment center that I'd been in. You know what? I remember sleeping and laying my head down, and you know what? My head was quiet, and I was absolutely happy with absolutely nothing. I had no prestige. I had no power. I had no status. I had nothing. But in my life, I was passing on the only thing that I had, and that was a little bit of hope to the next guy, and that was my primary purpose, and I found freedom. Now, I've also come to find that Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life just glorious enough to kill yourself with if you decide to manage it. And I will tell that story now. I stayed sober for the next 5 years. And I'm going to tell you what, man, I stayed solid into it. I got in these 12 steps and started sponsoring a number of guys. I was going into institutions on a weekly basis. I was hitting meetings left and right, man. I went back to college. I got a couple degrees. I got out of college, and I got into a pretty decent job. I met a woman. I got married. My wife, she was going to kill me if she ever hears that. And, dear Lord. I said old lady one time, and you should have seen the look I got. Like, duh! And, yeah, first time, last time. And anyhow, so I ended up getting married. I ended up having children. I got a nice home. I actually got into a pretty good social network of people. You know what I mean? Like, life was getting good. I got involved in AA a little bit less because I started seeking a little bit more money. You know, I had to enhance my occupation. Got in some, you know, government contracting and some things of that nature. And so what ended up happening was that about 5 years sober, 4.5 years sober, I had this idea, you know, that I've been doing this for a long time and that my family, you know, is, they're okay. You know, everyone's kind of happy. These guys I'm working with, they're okay, happy. You know, it's probably time that I just get some balance in my life now. And so I went in search of balance. And what I was going to do is I was going to spend some time, you know, with people outside of AA more, you know, because, I mean, heck, I'm an alcoholic, but, you know, I have a different life now. I can't just hang out with drunks all the time. And the whole time I'm just pulling back from AA. I'm sponsoring less and less guys now because it just takes too much time. And there's other things that are happening in my life. I'm getting kind of busy. And I finally just pulled away from AA entirely for about 6 months, I guess it was. And I'll tell you what, man, if you miss a couple days of meetings, 3 or 4 days of meetings, it's really not hard to get back. But once you pull away for a week, my experience, it just starts getting a lot harder to walk back. You know what I mean? It's just like, way overrated. They brainwashed me. And so I was away for a little bit, you know, and I got into other things. And my wife is not an alcoholic. And she was, drinking beer, eating pizza one night. And I thought, you know, why not? You know, why not? And so here I am, right, you know. And I thought, you know, wait, AA says no, don't do it. So I held off, you know. And I'm battling like this. And here I am at 5 years sober, sitting on my nice leather furniture in my nice big house with my college degrees and my wife and my beautiful children playing on the floor. And all I want to do is put a bullet in my head. That's it. The glory of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, like, what is this? And come to find out today that that was not Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the glory of Mike Schiff running his own life. But there I was, and all I could think about was being 3 weeks homeless without a drink and being happy. And here I am with everything I could want and being miserable. You know? It just didn't make sense to me. So I did the very thing that I feel today kept me alive. I drank. I took a drink. And I'll tell you what happened. I found relief. It was like just a breath of fresh air. Now, it only lasted for a minute. And then it got really bad really fast. And so I found my way, you know, into this life where I'll just tell you kind of where it took me to. And then I'm going to stop with that one. But my drinking kind of progressed, and by the end of it turned into something I never experienced before in my life. Within about 9 months of drinking, my drinking was up to about 3 to 4 fifths of vodka a day. And that's how I drank. And I didn't drink to get drunk anymore. And I didn't get drunk because I thought it would be a nice activity. I didn't drink to be social, and I didn't drink to be fun. I drank to function, and I drank to survive. I'd wake up in the morning about 3 o'clock, and this is what my hands would be doing. About like this. And I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink water. I couldn't brush my teeth. And I would get into the shower, and I would try to wash up. And I'd puke up about a quarter pint of blood. And I'd get back out, and I'd dry off. And by the time I was dry, I had just stuff just pouring out of my pores again. And I would just stumble over, I'd start to get dressed, and all I had to do was just, if I had that pint left, just get a pint of vodka in me, and this would go to this. And then I could go. Then I could get ready for work. I could be okay, I could function. And so I get there, I start to do that, and then next thing you know, I load my kids up in the car. I take my little one, I had a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old at the time, and I take these kids off to school, you know, and to the daycare. And then I'd head off to work, and I'd stop at the liquor store, and I'd get a couple fists on the way in. And I would drink about every 2 hours, you know, it would start back again. And I'd get a pint in me about every couple hours. And man, I could remember partying, you know, and I could remember being like this. I don't know what happened. I don't know where this transition took place. You know, there was like a point where I took the drink. And then I could see the point where the drink began to take the drink. And now I'd come to this point where the drink had taken me. Absolutely taken me. And I was a slave to it. Absolutely. And so I'd go to work, you know, and I tell you, there were many a days where, you know, I would just go out for lunch and I would just put down a pint or two just to go in and finish my day. And I would get out of lunch, you know, get back to work, and I would, you know, I was starting to have situations stumble at work. You know, people knew something was wrong, but it was just not, you know, there just wasn't enough there to, like, really slam the door shut on me. And on a government installation, mind you, they're not fond of this. And so I'd make it home, you know, and I'd just go, and I'd be driving home, and I'd get up to the babysitters, and I'd get to the school to pick the preschool to get my youngest, and I'd have to get just a little bit of vodka in me just to have a steady hand when I went to get them. And I'd get the kids at home, and I'd start doing, you know, whatever homework or doing, you know, making some dinner. And then I'd start up really bad again, and I'd be out of vodka. So I'd tell the kids, you know, hey, guys, we got to go to the juice store. So we'd load up the kids in their car seats, and we'd go down to the liquor store, and I'd get them their juice. And I'd get a couple more bottles for me. And we'd go home, and we'd start to finish up dinner. And the next thing you know, I come to, and it's 4 a.m., and I'm passed out in my driveway. My wife is a nurse working a night shift, and I have no clue where my kids are. And the first thing I do, as much as I love my children, is I go take a drink. And then I start going through my phone, incoming, outgoing calls, and I find that I've made this trip, and I left them at this place. They wouldn't let me take my kids with me because I was drunk. And I bring my kids, get my kids, and I get them back home before my wife gets home from work, and I swear it's never going to happen again. Ever, 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 ever. Today I would lay down my very life for my children. Then I would have laid down my very life for my children. But it came to the point where I, as the big book talks about, I had lost the power of choice in the drink. For reasons yet obscure, I had lost that power of choice. I had no longer got the right or the opportunity to make the decision on whether or not I was going to drink. And I'd wake up the next morning, and you know what? I wasn't going to drink, but then this would start. And it was either function or go to detox, you know? One or the other. And I had to make money, you know, whatever it was delusional in my head. So anyhow, what ended up happening is that's kind of how it began. I can remember coming to sometimes, going to lunch and coming to, and it's 6 p.m. and I'm already home with the kids, having no idea what's happened between 12 o'clock and 6. Going back to work the next day, every day of the week. I spent months like that. I started going back to meetings drunk. I could quote that big book drunk. You know what I mean? I know that big book real, real well. And you can see where they got me. You know, it's not the knowledge. It's the absence of action that got me there. And it was the absence of action that was keeping me there. And so what ended up happening is eventually everything in my life just went poof, gone. And I came to a point of desperation yet again. I was actually in this little institution. I went into detox, and I had a 0.54 blood alcohol level. And they told me I wasn't going to make it through the night. And I said, don't you know who I am? I'm Michael Schoaf. I remember that. And I remember these nurses going by and their mouths moving and cussing at me. And I remember something underneath my bed, and that was it. Next thing I knew, I was in a jacket, in a white padded room, and my alcoholic people were on the other side of the glass. And apparently I made some declarations to these staff that I shouldn't have made. And I was locked up. And I had a roommate, and his name was Raymond. And Raymond made a lot of strange noises. Now, Raymond was really crazy. Raymond had some issues. And he would chirp and he would bark. And I was very afraid of Raymond. And I remember being in this room with Raymond chirping at me, and I walked out of my room, and we had this like little section we could live in. And Raymond just kept doing his thing, and I said, "Oh my God," and I went to the little square window, and I was like hitting on it with my arm. And the nurse came to the window and said, "Can we help you?" I said, "I need out of here. I am not like these people." And she said, "Mr. Schoaf, that's not what your chart says. Now go back to your room." And so I went back to my room, and I said, "Raymond, are you crazy?" And Raymond said, "No." And I thought, "Oh my God, neither one of us are crazy, Raymond." And it like started to sink in, and I remember I hit my knees, and I fell into this place of absolute, I don't know what happened, but I can tell you in my heart, for the first time in my life that I ever really know that I like to own my life. And I just let God have it. Just let him have it. And I tell you what, it was in that room with Raymond that I just let my life go, and I just said, "God, take it all, good and bad, all of me. I'm done." You know, I wasn't out of ideas. If an alcoholic tells you he's out of ideas, he either needs more time or he's lying, I swear. But I had ideas. I just knew what my ideas got me. You know, and I was just done, and I just said, "God, take me." And I began to think things were going to be okay, you know. I entered into, that was February 26th of 2000, or February 4th of 2006. And that was my second period of sobriety. I ended up staying sober from that point. I got back into a very similar course of action. And I'm going to speed this up because I really want to get into, like, the riches of God and service to others in life today. But I'll tell you what happened was I rocketed, you know, into a fourth dimension, really, as I ended up going into York, Pennsylvania. They sent me to a rehab, told me I needed it. And I said, "Whatever, okay." You know, that was my response for the next few months. "Okay." "Okay." Mike, "Okay." And it serves really well, good purpose, actually. If you have a sponsor, and just say, "Okay." And it works well. So I just said, "Okay, man." And they sent me up to this rehab, and they sent me to York, Pennsylvania. Now, York, Pennsylvania has recovery houses, peppermint patties, crack, and more recovery houses. Some bars and more recovery houses. I swear, there's like 126 recovery houses in York. And if you walk down the street, someone's either high, drunk, or in recovery. It's just the way it is there. It's crazy. But I went there, and I ended up meeting the sponsor that I have today. And he got me into a little bit of a different take on the life that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he began to talk to me a little outside the box that I was familiar with. And he began to talk to me about these principles. And he began to talk to me about the purpose of these 12 steps and what they do and what they don't do and what we're doing here and what we're not doing here. Because I really was into, like, you know, coming in and just, you know, staying very, 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 very active, getting all kinds of craziness going on in my life. You know, I've got to go do this. Now I'm going to go to the softball match. Then we're going to go out bowling. We're going to stay at the diner. I'm going to drink 48,000 cups of coffee, smoke 10 packs of cigarettes, and I'm not going to be able to drink because I'm just too freaking wired. You know, that was AA for me for a long time, you know, just absolutely crazy. And what I found was I found a whole different position. And so he got me in. I gone to this guy. I remember, and I asked him for some help. And he said, "You know, Mike, I'll tell you what I'll do." I asked him to sponsor me. And he said, "You know, what I'll do is how about if I just show you how to pass this thing on to somebody else? How about if I show you that?" And I said, "All right." Finally, someone saw my greatness. You know what I mean? Like, he knows. He knows what's up. And so this guy began to take me through these 12 steps in a way that I've never experienced. He sat down and he talked to me about AA and where we came from and how we came about. I'd never heard this story before. Ever, ever, ever. You know, he talked to me about where we came from, and then he talked to me about the principles of these steps, which, you know, I always thought I knew. But what I found is I didn't necessarily know what I think I know. And then what he began to tell me is in the very gates, he says, "You know, Mike, the deal is these 12 steps do two things really, really well. First thing they do is they put you in a relationship with the power that solves your problem. The second thing they do is they allow you to help others. And, you know, and that's it. So as you take these steps, the only reason we're going through this is so that you can pass this on to someone else. And that, you know, your problems are you. And you thinking about you. You know, and I tell you today, man, I've never once can tell you one time in my life where I've ever been anxious, depressed, worried, frustrated, or anything where I wasn't thinking about me. Every single time. It's always me thinking about me. And you know, and my his solution to me is always the same. You know, help someone else. Help someone else. Help someone else. And so what ended up happening was I took this guy's direction. And I went through these 12 steps. And you know what? I just began to go around and I began to show up. And I quit trying to change AA. You know? I just began to make myself available. And I began to show up in these places where people were broken, where people were hurting. You know? And I began to show up where I saw people that were hungry. And I just began to reach out my hand. And I just began to help a ton of people. Which was really good because at this point in time I had just been, you know, issued, you know, divorce papers in sobriety. I'd thought, wow, you know, and I was actually trying to fix the marriage, which is half the reason I got them. And my kids were still at this point scared to death of me. I had, you know, lost all, you know, career opportunities. It was just a mess. Your life was a mess. But he just got me into this, and I'll tell you what happened was that I finally took my hands off of fixing my own life. And I just got a primary purpose of helping another alcoholic for the sole purpose of recovery. You know? And that was it. My life got really simple. Let me tell you what happened as a result. This is where it gets crazy. I ended up coming back to Virginia. You know, as I did this, man, I just laid off. I went home. I was just a dad. I went around my wife, and I was just a guy. Not even a husband anymore. You know? I didn't need her to need me and need anything like that. Just kind of, well, how can I be of service? You know, I went into these rooms and I showed up and I reached out my hand out consistently. And what ended up happening was, my wife, around 10 months over, said, "You know, Mike, we've just torn up the divorce papers and we want you to come home." Yeah, I was like, "Wow, you know, this is crazy." My kids just began to love being around me. My work status—I was working in a grocery store at the time now—and I went from, you know, design and marketing into, you know, sales into government contracting into grocery store. It was just a really weird transition. Not to mention I worked with produce. Fruit. And so here I am and now I'm ready to come back home and I don't know what to do. And I tell you what, I was freaked out about what to do. And my sponsor said, "You know, Mike, the only thing you need to do is help another alcoholic. That's it. You go out and pass this thing on to someone else. You know, the only reason you're bored is because you're not working with enough new guys. Now, go help someone." Or the only reason, you know, he'd have a lot of them, but anyhow. So we got into this life, dude, and I'll tell you, stuff just began to happen. And the whole thing about jobs, you know, started getting crazy. I'll tell you guys a real quick story as a result of God working in my life. I actually had this job that I was in the marketing and design industry, and I'd gotten all kinds of great, worked my way up from college, you know, to a point of, like, real good salary, really good, I guess, qualifications in the industry that I'm in. And all of a sudden, there's this period where there's nothing. And then there's this period of a grocery store for like a year, you know? And I'm telling you, no matter what, when you go back, you know, every company has a form of self-preservation. So they like to ask, what happened? And so if you don't put anything, they want to say, what happened? And if you put something down, they want to say, what happened? Because you just don't go from, you know, a government contracting position to working in produce. It's weird. And so I would start going to these interviews, and my wife says, "Honey, you got to make some more money," and da-da-da-da. And finally, I'm like, oh, dear God. So I start putting out my resume, and I go to these interviews. And I'm coming back to Northern Virginia, and I'm like, dear Lord. I meet these guys, and they say, well, you know, ask me the questions. You know, tell me about yourself and this and that. And they say, finally, at this point, what happened? And I start to tell them, and their eyes get real big, and it's just over. You know what I mean? Like, I know. Like, at first I started lying, then I got into just, I'm not sure what I was trying to do. And then I started kind of telling the truth, then I overdid the truth. So 6 or 7 interviews go by, right? And each and every time, they just are like, oh, my God, we'll call you, you know? And so finally, at the last one, you know, I finally given up on this whole deal, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to be working in produce for the rest of my life. This is just it for me. You know what I mean? Like, I need a job, and I can't get one, and da-da-da-da. So anyhow, I get this call from this guy who had gotten my resume from someone else who had my resume. And he wants to meet with me. He doesn't have a position available, but he wants to meet with me. Just weird enough, right? You know. So I go and I meet with the guy, and he asked me the same thing, well, what happened? And I said, you know what, I'm a drunk, you know. That's it. I'm a drunk. And I was drinking enough vodka to kill a small farm animal, and therefore I couldn't work, and therefore, you know, I ended up working in the produce department to learn how to live sober. That's what happened. Do you want me to leave? And he said, well, what happened after that? And I began to tell him. And he said, you found AA? And I said, yeah. Actually, AA kind of found me, but we found each other. You know, and he says, tell me about AA. So I start to talk to him about Alcoholics Anonymous. And for 20 minutes, he asked me questions about AA. And his eyes are getting, you know, watered up. And this is a new experience, all right? I'm not sure what to make of this. And so I just answer his questions. And afterwards, he walk around, and he shows me his shop, and he shows me his company. It's a small printing and design company. And he begins to introduce me to people. And at the end, we come back to his office, and he says, you know, Mike, I want to tell you a story. I have three children. And my oldest daughter is an alcoholic. And we've battled for years and years and years and years and years and years with her. And we've taken her everywhere, absolutely everywhere, treatment centers, you know, counselors, therapists, everything and nothing. And finally, we just had to let her go because we just couldn't help her. And she leaves, and we kicked her out. He said we didn't hear from her for like a month and a half. And then we got a phone call. And she says, Dad, it's me. It's Shelly. And I just want you to know that I'm okay. And they wanted to know how she was doing and what happened. And she said, well, I left your house. And I went out that night. And I ran into this girl who knew I needed help. And she took me to my first AA meeting. And she became my sponsor. And she took me through the 12 steps. And I'm doing okay. He said, that was 2.5 years ago, and she's still sober. And he said, my prayer to God has been, God, give me a way to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, but they won't take my money. They won't take anything from me. He said, so I think by giving you a job is my way to get back to AA, what AA has given me. All right? So he asked me what I need to make. And I just gave him the bare minimum of what I need to make to support my family of 4 children by now, okay? And we have a hockey team, dude, I'll tell you. And so what he says is, he says, okay. And he ends up sending me an email, and he offers me twice what I asked for, full benefits. And he says, you know, Mike, anytime you need to make a commitment or do something for AA, you feel free to just take the time to do it. And he pays me for it, for my time. Yeah? Isn't that crazy? So anyhow, that's God in Alcoholics Anonymous right there. That's what that is. Things got really good, you know, and I'm going to, dear Lord, that can't be right. Holy shnikes. My God. So, wow. Okay. God help. So anyhow, here's what happened, man. As I tell you, when I stayed this course, my family just became strong and incredible, and we just grew together, and things just became, I mean, off the charts, awesome. And then all of a sudden, life started getting crazy again. We had our 4th child, and my wife started working a lot more, and she's a nurse. And, you know, we've got this house, and I've got this job, and I've got, you know, I'm sponsoring 7 guys, you know, and I'm doing commitments to juvenile detention centers, and I'm running all over the place into treatment centers, and I'm going to 6 meetings a week, and my wife just says, Mike, I need your help. And so I made this decision that I was just going to take some time off of AA at 2 years sober, okay? That's what I was going to do after all this God work into my life. And I'll tell you what, it was a lot different, but I took some time off, and this was the thing, is I was just going to take some time to let kids get situated and for my kids to get stable, all right? That's all I was going to do. And all I did was walked away for 3 weeks, all right? I stopped going to meetings. I told the guys I was sponsoring to help somebody else for right now. They'll be around. If you need me, call me. But all I did was work from home because I was paying close to $1,000 a week in child care. And I needed to cut back on some of those expenses. I needed, you know, things in the laundry to get done. And that's all I did was just concentrate on my home. Well, anyhow, I did this for about 3.5 weeks. And I opened up the fridge one night, and my wife, who's a non-alcoholic, now picture this, right? I've got my oldest child, who's 9, is putting like these little crackers and Ritz crackers and all kinds of stuff. You know, she saw this Ratatouille special DVD. She's making these little desserts all over the kitchen. My 5-year-old, who was 4 at the time, is unscrewing all the light plates off the walls, the electrical plates, with my screwdrivers, right? My 2-year-old is taking toilet paper from the 3rd floor, pulling it down, and filling the toilets with it. My 6-month-old is just screaming his janker off in this chair, right? And this is my life, all right? And I'm just here to help. And so I open up the fridge to get him a bottle, and I notice in the bottom rack there was a wine bottle that's been there for about 4.5 months in my fridge with a wine saver in it. Don't ask about the wine saver. I can't help you. And I looked at that bottle, and I'm going to tell you what, I did not plan to take a drink that day. That was not my plan. But I'll tell you what, for 3.5 weeks, I became absolutely 100% unplugged. And I had no defense between me and relief. None. You know, the most noble of causes and conditions, the most noble thing in the world to take care of my family. And I open it up, and I take that bottle, and I put it to my mouth. And before I even know I'm getting drunk, I'm drinking. I drank for 3 days. At the end of 3 days, I was in a hospital, saying I wasn't drunk. I really was. And they did all these tests on me to help figure out what was wrong with me. Sure you're not drinking? Yeah. I'm going to be paying this amends, this medical restitution for about the next 3 years. I could have just said I was drunk and it'd be fine. But no, MRI, CAT scan, but you know what's funny is they did all these tests on me, and at the end of it they said, you know, Mike, the only thing we can find is that your liver is swollen, your pancreas is inflamed, and 40% of your blood is alcohol. I said, well, I don't know how that can be. I haven't been drinking. And they said, well, we're just going to keep you here until the alcohol you didn't drink gets out of your system. And they did. So anyhow, I left there, and here's the deal, right? Here I am now, 30 years old, almost 30. I've got a wife. I've got a children. I know better. I know better. I know better. What am I doing? Action or inaction? You know? If I take these actions and these 12 steps and I consistently make the time and availability to reach out and pass this thing on to somebody else to help another drunk get sober for the sole purpose of recovery, to just take the time on a daily basis to share with another alcoholic, if I reach out there and I let God direct my life and I let Him take care of me and I get out of the management business and I don't worry about my finances because God's the one who's paying my bills anyway, when I don't worry about my car and who's going to get it from point A to point B. I heard a guy say one time that, you know, you can tell that someone's spirituality is directly proportional to the amount of times you change your oil in your car, you know, in AA. Because, you know what, it's like I'm always worried about gas, but God just gets me from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting to state to state to state. He gets me there. And it's, if I can just stay out of the management business, stay out of it, man, life gets good and it stays good. You know, but what I do is I start practicing the program of Mike Shove and not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous is real simple. 12 steps put me in a relationship with God. The power fills my heart, fills my life, makes me an effective instrument to help others with. And I begin to help others and life just begins to take on new form. Anyhow, by the grace of God, my family has taken me back. And again, same family. I'm even at the same job. My boss said, Mike, we love you, but you cannot drink and work here. You know, I was just, man, it was a mess. Let me tell you about life today in the next minute. I love AA, and I give it all my heart, without question. Today I sponsor a number of guys, too. I work with a lot of guys I don't sponsor. I found that you don't necessarily need to sponsor the world, you know, in order to work with other alcoholics. You know, the ones you don't sponsor actually listen better, too. You know, it's amazing. I have a sponsor who I talk to on a regular basis just because I've fallen in love with them, you know. And I came into AA to help another alcoholic because it's what I need to do to stay sober. And today I do it because I can't imagine not doing it because it's just the passion of my heart. It's helping others. You know, I drive lots of distances to go places for AA. My wife and I sat down. We got some common goals in the house today. You know, we were both going in such different directions. Today we have an experience where we are, we have God dependence. You know, home where we're just concentrating on God dependence and service to others. We have alcoholics in our house a good bit, and we spend a lot of time working with them together. My wife's really kind of gotten into you guys. She really thinks you're something else. And there's no place else you find people like us. I'll tell you a real quick one here. You know, I have kids that I come home, and here's what my son says today. I come home from work, and I get in the door, and he says, "All right, Dad, open meeting, closed meeting, jail meeting." And I said, "Son, we're going to a closed meeting tonight." He's like, "All right, open meeting, yeah." You know, and he comes with me. My kids are real involved. My wife is absolutely committed to this. You know, you can tell me AA doesn't work, but do not tell my wife and kids that. I won't fight with you. They will. They really will. We just had our 6-year anniversary, our wedding anniversary. My wife and I did. And good Lord. 3 o'clock, or it was 12:30 at night, and we get all the kids out to a family member's house. We finally have the house to ourselves, right? We get dinner, nice dinner. We go snuggle up in the bed, and ring! She says, "Steve!" But no, it wasn't Steve. It was a new guy, you know, who I'd taken a few meetings, and it was this guy who was drunk. And I'd taken him a few places. 12:30 of all the nights. I haven't had a night with my wife in like a month and a half. And he says, "I need to go to detox." And I'm like, "Dear God." And so I said, "Kizzy, should I take this guy to detox?" And she says, "You know what, Michael? If it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, we wouldn't have an anniversary. And if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, we wouldn't even have a marriage. So why don't you go help that guy? And then when you come home, just wake me up." You know, I love AA. I'll keep coming back.